To me, way.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of The Shanty Show, a show about shanties. My name's Tim.
Hi, I'm Stefan. Tim, it's about time you joined us. It's good to have you here.
And I'm James, and our guest today is Mr. Alex McMurray from the Valparaiso Men's Chorus, and we're going to hear a little bit about how that project came together and about the music scene in New Orleans.
This one's called A Long Time Ago. Away down south where I was born to be way high, among the fields of golden corn,
a long time ago.
Up me mind to sail to sea
to me way high-o.
I made up me mind to sail to sea
a long time ago.
It's a long, long time, it's a very long time
to me way high-o.
A long, long time, it's a very long time,
a long time ago.
And I wish to God I would never was born
to be way high.
Go rambling and rambling around Cape Horn
a long time ago.
Around Cape Horn where the wild winds blow
to me way.
Snow
a long time ago.
It's a long, long time, it's a very long time
to me way high.
A long, long time, it's a very long time,
a long time ago.
But it's around Cape Horn that we must go
to me way high.
Around Cape Horn to Callio
a long time ago.
Around Cape Horn with frozen sails
way high.
Around Cape Horn to fish for whales
a long time ago.
It's a long, long time, it's a very long time
to me way.
It's a long, long time, it's a very long time,
a long time ago.
It's a long, long time, it's a very long time
to me way.
A long, long time, it's a very long time,
a long time ago.
All right. Awesome.
That's great.
Well,
so good.
I'm very excited for today's show. We have got Mr. Alex McMurray from the Valparaiso Men's Chorus based down in New Orleans, Louisiana. Alex, welcome.
Hey, everybody.
Very good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Yeah. So I wanted to kick things off by talking about how I first heard about the Valparaiso Men's Chorus, which was from a fellow in Toronto called Al Gasser. And Al was a teacher at York University when I went there for my music undergraduate degree. And we started Press Gang Mutiny in 2013. And we were at the Cameron House, which is sort of one of the great live music venues in Toronto on Queen Street West there. And Al happened to be in the audience, and he said right away, he said to me, "Have you heard of the Valparaiso Men's Chorus?" Which I had not heard of at the time. And fast forward a few years, and I was hanging out with this really great couple out of Windsor, Ontario, called Kathy and Greg Russo. And they're huge fans of New Orleans and the music that exists in New Orleans. And they asked me, had I heard about the Valparaiso Men's Chorus? At which point I said, yes, I've heard of them, but I don't know very much about them. And they had sent me this album, which is very kind of them. So thank you very much, Greg and Kathy. So that was my sort of introduction to the Valparaiso Men's Chorus. And the more I sort of thought about it, I thought to myself, this is a really a really perfect name for a shanty project, because there's so many references to Valparaiso or Valpo, which was a city kind of halfway up the coast of Chile. So for all those sailors who successfully rounded the Horn, that was a really enticing place that they would end up spending their hard-earned pay and all that kind of thing. So Alex, would you like to maybe tell us a little bit about how you came up with the name and the origins of the group?
It just kind of came to me. I mean, because as you say, so many of the songs mention that port, you know, on the coast of Chile, and where they would stop for water and they would collect guano, you know, and they'd, you know, they'd drop off, I guess, maybe whale oil or whatever, stuff. And they would get the guano, which of course they'd make into saltpeter, which you need to make dynamite and gunpowder and stuff. And so, and it was, you know, one of these just famous port towns. And for some reason, I don't know, when I was doing my, when I was first learning sea shanties for my Disney job, which I guess we'll talk about, I kept on hearing, you know, Valparaiso, Valparaiso, Valparaiso. And I, for some reason, I don't know, it just sounded like there had to be, if you're going to have a sea shanty band, it would have to be called the Valparaiso Men's Chorus. You know, I don't know why, but that was just, it just, it was never, there was never any doubt that that's what the band would be called if there were to be one, you know.
Well, it's an excellent title. And the first album too is Guano and Nitrate, which is also just such a perfect title.
Yes, the first record, yeah.
You guys have it's an atypical setup for what you typically encounter as a shanty listener, both the size of the group and the type of instrumentation. How did that all come together?
It just all gets put through this New Orleans filter, you know. When I was working at Disney, I was an atmosphere guy, so I'd walk around with a sea captain's outfit, you know, costume on, like a 19th century Ahab, Captain Crunch kind of, you know, dude. And I'd be wandering around singing Drunken Sailor to Japanese tourists, Japanese grandmas, you know, and rolling around just because, and I was like 31 and I, you know, very baby faced and like, you know, you got to shave every day to work at Disney and all this. And, you know, you got to get a haircut every 2 weeks and just very weird. And like in this very antiseptic McDonald's kind of a vast dining room, bizarre, you know, one day I was rolling around and I'm doing Drunken Sailor. And I did it like with this kind of up-tempo New Orleans beat, like they call it a street beat here, second line beat. And I was like, wow, you know, this would really sound good with this particular drummer, Carlo Nuccio, and this tuba player named Matt Perrine, some of the guys that I work with a lot. And that just, so it just stuck in my head. And then it was always something I wanted to try, but never really did until a few years after I got back. And there was this, well, we can talk about, I don't know if I can talk about it now, but
yeah,
but it was, the idea was to do, take these songs and do them with a New Orleans instrumentation versus usually it's, you know, fiddles and, you know, a squeeze box. And, instead of that, we would have drums and, a tuba or sousaphone more specifically, and a trombone, and percussion instruments. And do it like, you know, in New Orleans, we have these second line parades that go down the street. And it's like, you know, usually like there's the funeral and the family. And then the second line is the people that are following, cause they have a band to escort the casket to the grave. And then after that's done, all the dirges, they do party music, you know, and then the people that are following, cause they want to hear the band. They all, you know, and they, everybody's got a bottle and, you know, everybody starts to tear it up, you know? So I thought a lot of this music would be great for that kind of second line approach, you know? So that's pretty much what, that is the germ of what we do is that. And we also do, you know, we do have two accordions presently, and a penny whistle player and a fiddle player, you know. And so we do, we have that sound as well, you know, but coupled with the New Orleans instruments.
Now, the first album, if I'm not mistaken, seems to be more along the lines of the Tin Men.
Yeah, the core of it was me and Matt and Chaz. In fact, we financed the first record because we had a budget for making, you know, we have a band fund. Mm-hmm. So we're like, well, we can dip into our band fund and finance this recording, or actually the duplication of the recording. And we got paid back, whatever, you know. So like, but it kind of started as an extension of that core of the me and Washboard Chaz plays the washboard, and which is seems very fitting for this music, you know. And the tuba player who's very facile, and myself, and for the first recording we had a viola, and all happened one day, you know. We had accordion and viola and trombone that we added, and drums.
Because what I love about that first album is it sounds like somebody just pushed record on a great party that just happened to have a bunch of people who knew shanties at it and other great musicians and just captured it all.
Well, it was, yeah, by necessity. We went out that day and bought like the last two reel-to-reel tapes that existed in the town. We had to go to this weird store, and we only had this much, you know, we had like 20 or 30 minutes of tape. So if like we didn't get the take, we would do it again, and we probably only had two or three takes in us. And it was they were filming it. It was really for a film project. And so I just called all these people I knew, dudes, you know, to come and sing. And we had the band, and there was no rehearsal. We ran over the tune, and, you know, I would show everybody the song. It goes like this, and they're simple, you know, and we just had two or three shots at it, and that was it. And if we didn't get it, there was no overdubbing, there was no anything. So it's like, it's very raw, very, you know, and like, you know, like the guy that I worked with at Disney, the other Captain Sandy, who the sea shanty ex, my, the guy I know who knows more about sea shanties than anything, he heard the record and he was like, well, first of all, you're mispronouncing everything, you know, and, you know, and he's like, very interesting, Alex, you know, but there's a lot of spirit to that record. You know, there's a lot of, like you said, you know, I'm, it's as an artifact, it's pretty, it's something, you know, but it certainly doesn't, fit into the sea shanty canon. You know,
it actually reminds me a bit of, stuff that Stefan and I used to get up to in our late teens, early 20s, in the basement of my mom's house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Remember just, that? A very similar kind of sound where, people are just kind of making stuff up to fit in along the way and with, you know, no intention to really have a polished.
Right.
Yeah. The end of it. Yeah.
Well, I should put the biggest factor in all that is that it was recorded at a place called the Mermaid Lounge, which is a bar that happened to have a recording studio in it. Mm. And the bar was shutting down. They were going out of business. So they were like, just drink it. I mean, they're like, they had to get rid of their inventory. So we had like 8 hours in there, you know? So we were there from like 4 PM till midnight or whatever. So it was just like an open bar and the mics were on and so like some of the, you know, the performances from later in the evening are a little more ragged than the earlier ones, you know?
Well, I'd encourage everyone listening to give it a listen though. Cause you say it's, you know, not in the shanty canon. I think it deserves its place. Cause it just captures the right kind of mood of sort of a good social sing and party. And it's just such a perfect context for shanties.
We were listening to it with the family this morning in the kitchen, which is, you know, there's a few, you certainly don't censor anything in those tunes, but I don't think they could really make out the lyrics. Anyways, my 3-year-old says, this is fun music as he starts to dance. And that's, you nailed it. It must have been a hell of a time in that room.
It was, I mean, it was a party that, you know, people still talk about. It'd be great to, I should call the guy who did the film. I mean, there was a film crew So there's all this footage, and I've never seen it, and nobody has. I don't know what happened to it, you know?
And yeah, that'd be great to see.
That would be, you know, of course, it was like, when was this night? It was 2005 or 2004, I think it was recorded, even before Katrina, you know? And then, like, and then I moved out of town. I moved to New York, and then, like, the whole thing got forgotten, and then Katrina happened, and then suddenly people were like, hey, we have these audio tapes. Do you want to, you know, mix them? You know, we had to transfer them to digital. I mean, we did the machine that they were recorded on was this ancient reel to reel that was like really problematic. And the fact that it exists at all is kind of a miracle. You know, it took a minute to get, just to get the stuff stable, you know?
I forget which song it is, but there's this great sousaphone or tuba feature in one of the songs, and it just everyone else is just kind of screaming at this poor guy. It sounds like he's sort of
Offer Me Grog.
Yeah.
he makes pretend like he can't play the song in the right key.
That's right. He feels like he kind of loses his way, and he's trying to find his way back,
and he's got like that bippity boppity boo thing, but bippity boppity boo. And he can't get it right. And everybody starts screaming. And that was all kind of spontaneous. You know, I think he actually did mess up the line, and then he kind of made a joke out of it. I have to ask him.
That was such a fantastic
moment. It became part of the act, you know.
Yeah. Now, can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up in Tokyo at Tokyo Disney Sea.
Tokyo Disney Sea, yes, which is next door to Disneyland. The Tokyo theme park is so popular in Japan that they had to build another one. And the Disneyland had been there, you know, for 20 years plus or something when I was there. So it's 40 years now. And so they had just built Disney Sea to just kind of handle all the business. And a little bit more like entertainment oriented than, and there's some rides and stuff, but. There's a guy here named Adam Shipley who was at the time a talent buyer for Tipitina's, a very famous nightclub here. And he's from Orlando, Florida. And every few months or years, this guy from Disney would call him and say, hey, do you got a guy who can, like, you know, juggle plates on sticks? Or do you know a guy who can, like, you know, play the kazoo while riding a bicycle and juggle or something, you know? And one day the guy calls him, you know, he says, hey, do you know a guy who can sing sea shanties or something, you know, play the banjo or guitar and sing sea shanties. And so this guy, Adam, called a mutual friend, Glenn Hartman, and said, do we know anybody who can, like, sing or play guitar and sing sea shanties? And Glenn goes, well, what about Alex? And Adam says, oh no, this is for Disney. Like, I would never be able to, you know, I don't know. You guys don't know me from shit, but, I was not deemed appropriate. I was not deemed Disney ready. And in fact, they had like this betting pool here in town that how many weeks I would last on a 6-month contract, you know. But so I did an audition and I didn't get the job. And then 6 months later, and I haven't gone on with my life, I just forgot all about this. Had started two records, you know, in the middle of working on two records. And like, they're like, hey, Disney called and they want you, for the next contract, you know. Do you want to do it? And I'm like, how long do I have to think about it? And they're like, you have 48 hours, you know? So I ended up doing it. You know, it was right after 9/11. So it seemed like a good time to get out of town. And, you know, the money was good. And I was young and unattached and I, you know, could make these kind of decisions. And so I went, you know, 6-month contract.
Very cool. And then, if I understand correctly, the film footage that you're talking about sort of came out of that?
Yeah, there was a friend of mine who's a filmmaker. He wanted to do like a Les Blank kind of movie, like a short film, just on my Disney experience. Of course, there was no footage of me in Japan that we could ever find. So, I don't know, that project just kind of died. But they did some interviews with me and that recording session at the Mermaid Lounge.
Amazing. Now, lyrically, Richard kind of brought this up a little bit. So the lyrics in the two albums, from what I can tell, is sort of a great balance between what seems to me to be lyrics straight out of Stan Hugel's you know, great book, Shanties from the Seven Seas. Mm-hmm. And then you've got some other lyrics that I'm thinking are made up by yourself. And some of them are very, I feel that they're perfectly kind of the right level of crudeness of what you would have had in sea shanties, it, with a very funny twist to them. And I have to say there's also a funny sort of scenario that I think shanty singers find themselves in, where we have these lyrics from Stan, which are almost like the last communication of the real shanty men, right? And we sort of tend to revere some of these lyrics and not want to change them whatsoever. But in reality, there really was a lot of lyrical improvisation. I think that was the pretty much all the shanties were improvised. So
yeah.
I feel that you struck a really nice balance with paying respect to some of the, you know, codified lyrics, and also coming up with ones that are, you know, quite lighthearted and funny and kind of clever at the same time.
Yeah, well, you know, in the Hugo book, you know, he points out again and again that, like, you know, like, this is what, you know, they were all, depending on this, on the shantymen, you could go anyway, you know, and then there were an amalgam. I mean, these crews were from all over the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a guy'd be on a boat with, you know, group X, and then you go to the next boat and it'd be group Y. And then, like, you know, then, like, so this cross pollination would happen. And so, and I think that if you had a line, a topical funny line that, like, you know, maybe like the mate was up your ass about something, you could say something about the mate and then everybody would laugh, you know, ha ha. But, you know, and these things would, you know, in fact, you know, in a lot of these songs, you're talking about specific captains and specific, you know, and so some things would catch on, something, you know, some things get recorded. I've got about a dozen books now, you know, all the books that Stan Hugel talks about, you can get now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've collected them over the years. Like back in 2002, when I was doing this, I mean, there was only one sea shanty record I could find, and it was like the Robert Shaw Chorale. I don't know if you know that record, which is beautiful, but it's like it's something you'd go see at a university in a concert hall,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, like a 4-part, you know, men's chorale, like, you know, it must be like 20, 30 people singing.
And one thing, I forget if it was Mark Bernier or Jeff Kaufman was saying, was that these sailors were, you know, aside from the fact that, as you say, they're from all over the world, they're traveling much greater distances than anyone did at the time. They were also going to music halls in places like New York. And so they would have been exposed to current and popular music at the time. And, you know, if I think of New Orleans, obviously it's a seaport town. It seems like the maritime history is a big part of that. Was that something, I think you said you were from New Jersey originally, but
yeah,
is there some kind of sense of that in New Orleans, or is that kind of eclipsed by the, by kind of the jazz music and other kinds of music?
Well, New Orleans for sure is affected by its geography, and people often say that New Orleans is not, you know, one of the southernmost cities of the United States, but the northernmost city of the Caribbean.
Ah.
And it's very accurate. You know, there's a lot, I mean, a huge connection culturally between here and Cuba that went on in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And also with, you know, a lot of South America, you know, with, you know, banana trade and what have you. And so there, and being a port town, there's, you know, this city was controlled by the Spanish and then the French. And so there's, you know, it was a Catholic city too, which makes a big difference in terms of, like, cultural attitudes. And that's what, you know, it's why we have, you know, Mardi Gras and Carnival down here, you know. So it's just not as tight-assed as like, you know, you just go, like 100 miles north of here and it's just tight-assed as hell, you know. And it's just like this weird pocket of Catholic abandon, and just weirdness and tolerance. I find when I'm looking through shanties, looking for material, there's much more mention of Mobile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a lot of shanties coming, like that one we just did was apparently came out of Mobile, which I guess was a big port for cotton.
Cotton,
yeah.
You know, because it was closer to, but, of course, New Orleans' big export and import was human beings. And, that was the big market here, sad to say. So,
One thing I remember hearing and reading about is during the time of slavery, in the English-speaking colonies, drumming was really outlawed and feared in terms of, it could incite insurrection and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Spanish and French and Portuguese colonies, the practice of African drumming was allowed to continue.
Yeah, so that's
right. Something I would think would have influenced New Orleans a lot more than... Totally. Anywhere else in the United States at the time, really.
It was allowed at a place called Congo Square, which is still a place. It's, it's called Congo Square, and it's the same place. And on Sundays, especially, Africans were allowed to congregate and play drums and, get down. Mm. And Sunday is still a big day in the African-American week here. That's when things were really happening. It's when the second lines happen, and even Sunday night, I used to go to these clubs on Broad with this guy that I used to be in his band, and that was just a happening night. People would get dressed up, they go out to the Winner's Circle or the Pampy's Tight Squeeze, places like this. But As far as like a connection between with sea shanties and New Orleans, I haven't really seen too much, but of course I think there's probably a lot of mention of New Orleans because New Orleans is, was such a huge city in those days. It was actually we had the first opera house in North America here,
What has the reception been for the Valparaiso Men? What has that been like compared to, you have a number of other musical projects undergo? How have audiences in New Orleans sort of responded to the shanty side of things?
Thanks. They love it. It's like, I've been playing music professionally for over 30 years, and this is by far the most popular thing I've ever done. There's another band, but we only play like twice a year, like once in the fall and once in the spring, because it gets too hot in the bar, so we have to wait for the temperature to be right. And and so people will show up and you'll get like a couple hundred people, and people I've never seen, and and women, weird, my usual audience is not, it's funny usually when I play a gig, I know 80% of the people in the audience, but not for this, the Valpos. So it's kind of by word of mouth, and people come and they're a lot of them are prepared to sing. And we spend the first set is usually like, we take the first few songs and we break it down, this is your part and we're going to do this part and then you do this part and then okay, here we go, kind of like a Pete Seeger sort of instructional, a primer or whatever, before we do the tune. And once the people start singing, that's then you're home free. But then again, there's enough of us that it seems like everybody's singing.
Now, New Orleans really strikes me as a place where there's a lot of eclectic music going on. I think naturally associate jazz to New Orleans for obvious reasons. We, of course, New Orleans is the birthplace of ragtime piano, which then influenced kind of stride and boogie woogie piano and all that. But it feels like it's a city where there's a lot kind of going on at the same time. You can just go a few blocks in a different direction and you'll get some different types of music. And also you strike me as a very eclectic musician just from what I've read about you. You've got the Tin Men, and then there's 007 that I was mm-hmm. quite intrigued by. So that's a project that was focusing mainly on rock steady music.
Yeah,
which is interesting because rock steady really you got ska music that comes out of post independence Jamaica in 1962, and then by about 1967-68 you've got reggae that's taken over as the popular style of music, which is still very prevalent nowadays. but Rocksteady is that sort of missing link in between.
In between, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, yeah, it's when it kind of got slowed down a little bit. It wasn't quite the reggae. It's sort of, you know, of course, it was Toots who named reggae music.
Mm-hmm.
The reggae.
That's right.
And well, that band was started by a guy named Jeffrey Clemons, who there's a band called G11 Special Sauce
that, yeah,
you know, had a heyday. They're still playing. I mean, not right now, but, and he's the drummer with that band, and he moved here in the 90s and lived here until Katrina. And now he lives in Nashville, but we were friends, and he got into this rock steady music. He just started buying Jamaican music, and he just sort of zeroed in on Desmond Dekker and Toots and that kind of stuff in that era. So he started buying records from that era of like around 65, 66, 67. And he just found all these tunes that he loved, and he just decided to start a band, you know, just doing those tunes. And so, you know, he and I, and then we called this guy Joe Cabral, who plays bass, and a guy named Jonathan Frelick, who's a guitar player. And we, you know, started that band, and that's just a dance party, you know, and we're no apologies. We play covers. We try to do them as close as we can to the original. And there's no pretense of originality or anything, but we certainly would rehearse, and it was a good band, and it was a lot of fun. So people, that was the other band that I've been in that was oddly popular, and people would come out. Everybody would come out and they'd just dance. It's fun to play for a dancing crowd. I'd never had that experience.
And you had the great honor of opening for Toots and the Maytals, I was reading. Yes. So that must have been such a pleasure.
That was cool. During Jazz Fest, I can't remember what year, probably around 2008 or 9. And yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, huge honor. Hmm. And but I couldn't stick around for the gig because I was running Jazz Fest that day.
Okay.
I had to get back to like swab out the toilets and go through the trash and pick out the recycling and do glamorous things like that.
One of the things that just kind of came to mind while we're chatting here is the how music really is reflective of the environment that it comes out of. And I was just thinking, as you were talking about the connection with Cuban music in the 1800s and Cuban culture, I remember reading in Jamaica on clear nights, they could pick up some radio signals from, yes, New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
So they're influenced by the brass arrangements, you know, which then become a big part of ska music, become a big part of rocksteady and reggae.
There's a Fast Domino tune. I can't remember the name of it, which is like it. It sounds just like a ska tune, and you can say, oh my God, it is. They used to listen to New Orleans R&B down there for sure.
Well, another thing I think we could talk about is your appearance on the show Tremé. So for people who may not know Tremé, you should definitely check it out. It's a great show that takes place after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And what I like about the show, it really focuses a lot on the music culture and what it would have been like. So I can't imagine what it would have been like if your house sort of is affected by the hurricane and whatnot. Were you living in New Orleans during the time of Katrina?
No, I had moved to New York about in 2004, so a little less than a year before the storm. Of course, all my stuff was here, and it was in this house where I'm sitting. And in those days, I was a renter. Now I own the house, bought it from our friend. It's kind of a long story, but we're really close to the river levee. So that's the highest ground in town. I mean, like not the French Quarter is the highest ground. But there was no problem here, but five blocks that way, that's when it started getting deep, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a bowl, and in the middle of the bowl, that's of course like the most recent settlement is in the middle of the bowl. And that's where all the water was.
Yeah, I've taken a look at some of the photos, and it's just crazy to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like people, like Chaz's house, which is just a few blocks away, he's just about four blocks closer to the lake. And they, you know, they took a couple inches of water, but that's enough. You know, you got to tear out all your drywall and get the whole place. Right. That's it.
Yeah. I really love the scene your first appearance in Treme, where you're kind of just walking in the neighborhood and you happen to hear DJ Davis and the Brassy Knoll rehearsing, and you kind of stop in and say, you know, oh, hey, I was just in the neighborhood. And you pull out the guitar and they're all like, oh, hey, Alex, you know. So can you tell us a little bit how did that sort of come about?
Well, I mean, I guess they've been this was the second season. I can't remember. They've been, you know, working on it for a while. And I was just like, hey, man, when's my shot? You know, because I knew people in the cast. I knew people that were, you know, I knew, and I'd met David Simon, and I, you know, it's a small town. So, you know, and I, of course, good naturedly giving everybody a lot of crap about it, you know, like when, you know, and they're like, oh, don't worry. We're going to work you out. And so that storyline, I guess, was that the Davis character, Steve Zahn, who was a great guy, by the way, we hung out a lot when he was here, and his band was trying to get him out of the band, which is kind of like mirrors something that happened to the real Davis. So I guess my appearance in that storyline, I can't remember now whether it was like implied that I wasn't just walking down the street that day with my guitar just by happenstance, but that the band had like hipped me that there was going to be a rehearsal. So come to the rehearsal so we can, and you sit in and you blow that guy away and we can get rid of this guy, you know?
Right. The timing is perfect. Cause Davis actually, he does start a solo and the band's like, whoa, stop. Yeah. What was that? You know? And then you walk into the door like right away.
Oh,
and
hey, guys, what's happening? I just jamming. Yeah.
And then you shred a solo and then they're like, you know, you can see Davis just watching kind of like, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I guess I got on two or three episodes, which was nice. And that, you know, the best part was that they used a couple of my songs for, you know, in the show.
Yeah. So in season three, episode 7, I was looking this up this morning to be precise, the Promised Land, it features the Valparaiso Men's Chorus playing Drunken Sailor with Spider Stacy of the Pogues on the tin whistle. Can you tell us a bit about that? Like, is that a friend of yours, or how did that sort of fall in?
I mean, I had never met him before that day, you know. And that episode, it was directed by Tim Robbins. You know who that is? Mm-hmm. Actor. He was married to Susan Sarandon, I think, a minute. He was in the movie The Player, the Robert Altman movie. Anyway, he was in Bull Durham. He was the pitcher, like the knucklehead pitcher. Anyway, he's super tall, which is helpful when you're on a film set because there's billions of people running around and he's like a foot taller than everybody else. So he's able to command the room. But I'd never met Spider Stacy, and they're just like, you know, I guess they started early in the morning and it was supposed to be Mardi Gras. And so we all show up. They didn't tell us that we all needed to have costumes. And so I lived across the street from the bar. It was at the Saturn Bar, and I used to live right across the street. And so luckily we had an attic full of costumes like most people in New Orleans do, because you know, you never know when you need one. So we put everybody in some stuff, and some people had to go home, and then they're just like, do your thing. And so they're like, I'm like, what do you want us to play? And they're like, I don't know. And they're like, do something up. And I'm like, okay, Drunken Sailor. So we did that. And then Spider Stacy was there, and he was able to, you know, do his thing. And it was a fun time. We had a good time that day.
That's amazing. I think Spider was featured in a couple other episodes too.
Yeah, he had like a speaking role, I think.
He did, yeah. So Alex, one thing I wanted to ask you about is the Saturn Bar. It seems to be a venue that's very important to you and to the Valparaiso Men's Chorus. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, it's certainly, because I lived across the street. It was, for many years, it wasn't really a music venue. It was just a bar, you know, run by this guy, O'Neill Broyard. And, you know, if O'Neill felt like opening, then it would be open. If he didn't feel like opening, it would not be open. And he'd lived to 2005, just after the storm. And then when he died, his nephew and his nephew's daughter took it over. And it was still in the family. And so I managed to, like, sort of horn my way in there to play some gigs just by myself, or, you know, and then when the Valparaiso record was done, we wanted to do a CD release party, and we're like, oh, let's do it at Saturn, 'cause it's right there. And we did the show, and the room where we would set up is had a balcony going, well, along three of the walls. And there was like a I don't know, like not picket, like what do they call those? It's like a there's a banister and there's poles, right? Mm-hmm. It looked like the hold of a ship, you know? So there's people hanging over this thing and they're all singing, and the ceiling goes up, you know, to like the ceiling of a second story, you know? So it's just like this big room, and once we get everybody going, they would start to sway and, like, you know, do their glasses and everything. And it really felt like you're on a ship. Like it was, you know, and like you'd get sort of seasick almost. And it was like, and like the show itself was like unbelievable. You know, it was incredible. Cause people just got into it and just started singing. So there was never any intention to make this a band and do this again. It was just a one-off. But after that night, we were like, oh, we got to do this again, you know? So we did every, you know, maybe like 2-3 times a year we would perform, and that would be our home base at the Saturn Bar. We do it at this other place up the street, and it was okay. It wasn't the same, you know, they had a better sound system and it was easier to do, but it just, the vibe was not even close. So
it sounds like, I think you were saying earlier that at the Saturn Bar, the line between performer and audience is pretty blurry.
Yeah, there was no, since, I mean, just in, because of this the size of our ensemble, which is 9 musicians and about 20 guys, give or take. And, you know, so there's no stage. So there's the audience and the band, and we're all smashed in together. And hopefully the audience is singing, and we're, you know, so everybody's singing. It's just one big organism, you know? And so that, I mean, that was some great memories, you know. Hopefully we can do it again.
That makes me think that at its core, like, sea shanties is a very participatory style of music. And I think it lends itself well to being with the crowd there. I know that there's one venue in Toronto we like to play at in the West End called The Local on Roncesvalles. And it's a great spot to play, but it's a funny setup. Like, you have to walk through this very long, narrow bar, and then the stage is right at the back to the left, kind of facing a wall where only a few people can really sit there. So sometimes, you know, if it's not as busy, we'll just sit at a table and kind of sing there. And I've heard some people say that that's almost a more enjoyable experience, because it's just really, we're kind of there with on the same level as the people.
I think it's, it's like there's a place called DBA here in town that, like this, they spend a lot of money getting the stage nice and everything, but like you're up, and the stage used to be this little small thing. Now it's like it's bigger, but you're so far away from everybody, and you're up high, and there's this removal. And now bands have started setting up on the floor in front of the stage, you know,
that's
and
it cool.
sounds a lot better, you know,
it's
much more. That's the great thing about, one of the great things about the Saturn Bar was that we were all, there's no stage, you know, and there was no, so you're looking at people, I'm like, people are this close, you know, I'm like, there's just nowhere else for people to go. So, you know, if you're 5 people back, you're not going to see me. You're going to see the tuba, you know, and you're going to see the people up in the balcony, and you're going to just be part of the scene. You're not going to be like looking fixated on a band. You're just going to be in a thing, you know? So it's awesome to do it like that. You know, I love, you know, especially with like folk music or, you know, this kind of participatory thing to be with the people.
Mm-hmm. Now we're in February of 2021. Now we're almost a year into this global pandemic, which has put a grinding halt to pretty much all live music. I was reading a little bit about the Saturn Bar, and I've never been there, but I was sort of saddened to hear it's been sold. And from what you're saying, they don't really know who the new owner is yet. There's some speculation they want to keep it as a bar, but you know, I guess what my question is what's the vibe like for music venues in New Orleans, which is a city that's so synonymous with music? What's the current situation, and what is the future of live music venues looking like right now?
You know, who knows? There's, you know, people are trying to hang on. There's government programs, loans, things like that. Some bars are trying, you know, if you're a bar, you're allowed to sell drinks like out your front door, or, you know, like sort of one of these things. And so, you know, every place is different. Like, you know, the Saturn Bar, I don't even know what's going on. I mean, the Bailey and Rob, her soon to be husband, you know, these are friends of mine, but I don't know. I mean, I haven't, like, cause I don't see anybody. I got a little kid, you know? So I just like, I guess I could call her. She probably doesn't want to be bothered. I don't know, but she'd been running that place since she was, you know, like I said, 18 years old or so. And she's, you know, just turned 30 a little while ago, and she's getting married. And I think she's just like, it's, you know, there's a lot of work, you know, I think she wants nothing else with her life. So I don't blame her at all. I'm kind of on her side. It's like, you know, listen, you know, don't chain yourself to something like that for your whole life. You know, if whoever takes it on has half a sense, they'll just do as little as possible, stay out of the way, maybe, you know, fix up the bathrooms and, you know, put in a fire door. That's all you really need to do. And so who knows, but that's, you know, beloved places come and they go in this town, like, you know, you wouldn't believe. So, you know, certainly the musicians are doing their best to try to stay present. There's a lot of, you know, live streaming going on, you know, tons of that. I do a weekly thing. There's, you know, a lot of people doing, there's a lot of these porch party kind of things, which I've done a lot of. And, you know, you can, people will hire a band, a small band, to play on their porch, and, you know, their neighbors and stuff, they will assemble in the street in front of the house. Oh, and that's a lot of fun, you know. There is a place, this brewery that just opened up. Well, it used to be Dixie Beer, now it's Faubourg Beer. And they have a vast space, and they do outdoor shows. And so I play there sometimes, and there's bands every weekend. And you know, this place called Scyther Seafood I played at. And there's like just these little kind of places are springing up to kind of take up the slack, you know. But I certainly don't know what, like, your average drummer or, you know, trombone player is doing. You know, I guess there's playing in the street, but there's not a lot of foot traffic.
I was going to ask about that. I'm glad to hear that there are still some opportunities for musicians to play live. But one thing I noticed a lot of in New Orleans, particularly in places like the French Quarter, is this vibrant busking culture. And I think one of the outcomes of the pandemic is we're sort of shifting towards being kind of a cashless society, at least for the time being, where, you know, people are avoiding carrying change in their pocket or even dollar bills. Is this something, do you think, will have a lasting and potentially detrimental impact?
Everybody's got Venmo and PayPal now, you know? So if otherwise you're crazy, you have, cause you're right. There's no cash.
Okay. Another thought I had is, you know, Hurricane Katrina was 2005. So, you know, only 16 years ago. And the impact that must've had on musicians and for everyone in New Orleans, just rebuilding the city and rebuilding certain neighborhoods and whatnot. And now we've got the pandemic as well. It just seems like, you know, 16 years is not really that long for two major events like that to happen to a music scene. I'm just kind of curious what the vibe is like right now.
I think Katrina was an easier hurdle than this, because you, at least after Katrina, you could assemble with people.
Yeah.
You could have that humanity, you know. This thing is just so, you know, such a, it just messes up your mind so much, because you can't congregate, you can't commiserate, you can't celebrate, you know. This town is so much about celebration and about just humanness. And when you can't get near people, it just throws the whole thing out of whack, you know? So, like, you know, after Katrina, like, yeah, people got scattered to the, you know, to the winds, but, you know, people eventually made their way back if they could. Some people were just like, you know, they landed in Houston. They're like, yeah, this is much better than my situation in New Orleans or whatever. Some people ended up in New York. I was living in New York at the time and people were showing up every day. And we had these New Orleans jam sessions at this place called Niagara. And it was like all these crazy people playing together you never would imagine. And it was great and all. But like my wife and I at the time were like, we were thinking about moving back to New Orleans, you know, because it just was, New York is just tough, you know. But now it's like, I don't know, I guess everybody's like, there's the, all the people are connecting online, you know, and I think there are new relationships being made online, which hopefully will carry over, you know, humans are very resilient and, you know, we're going to get through it, you know, but it's, I have fears about is just people's mental health, you know, because, you know, if you're around people, you can be sort of, things are kept in check, you know, but if you're just isolated, I think that's, you know, I don't think it's good for people, you know, and I'm lucky because I, you know, I have my family and I do have some neighbors and some people that I'm, you know, I'm very well situated and I'm able to do a weekly live stream, which keeps the lights on, you know. But I'm very unique in that I can work alone, you know,
Right. Drummer.
I mean, not a lot of guys can like set up a drum set and be entertaining for an hour playing the drum.
And the trouble is with doing stuff online is we don't have the technology to live stream collaborative music projects yet. You know,
exactly right. Yeah. I mean, like you can't unless you record it and then do it and edit it together.
Which is kind of labor intensive and problematic as well.
Yeah.
Now, it's currently February 13th, and I can't help but notice that next this upcoming Tuesday is Mardi Gras. I was kind of curious. Sorry if this is a sore spot, but what? How different is this going to be this year? What's it going to?
Oh, it's totally different, and it's not a sore spot with me because, you know, frankly, The costume anxiety is not something I enjoy, you know. My wife is really good at costumes and she usually, it's like, then the burden sort of falls on her. And then, cause you gotta have, you know, you can't just go out, walk around as a regular civilian. You couldn't, you can't do that. So to not have that on us this year is kind of nice. Plus we have, you know, a 6-year-old, soon to be 7-year-old, and he's kind of a pain in the neck. Doesn't, you know, walking around all day in the sometimes cold weather, with, you know, adults drinking is probably not his favorite thing, you know, but in, you know, even after Katrina, when they had that first Mardi Gras, we had just moved back in February of 2006. And it was just like tears streaming down your face, you know, the first, you know, first sign of beads and stuff, just because of this, just that sign of rebirth, you know, that like the, like seeing the first buds on the trees. Not to have that this year, you know, I'm calling it mental gras. You know, people are decorating their houses, their porches, like Mardi Gras floats.
Okay, cool.
Parade floats, you know, and I don't know. It's people are just, they got to have something to do. People need to get their glue gun out. They're just like freaking out. They got to get crafty. And so, and people are going to dance in the streets. You can't stop that, you know, but I guess the cops are trying to keep people from assembling. And I'm, you know, I'm personally all for it, you know, because of the pandemic and all that, you know? But it's hard to keep people, it's hard to get people to behave, you know, which is, you know, for good or ill.
Well, yeah, especially about, you know, 11 months into this thing, I can imagine so many people would be just chomping at the bit to.
I mean, all the official stuff, all the parades are canceled. Yeah. Bars, they just came out last week. The mayor's like, all bars will be closed. No to-go sales, nothing. You cannot be on Bourbon Street. You cannot be on Frenchman Street. You cannot congregate underneath the overpass where the Indians hang out. You cannot, I mean, none of this. There's barricades. There's going to be cops. They're going to with nightsticks. I'm going to be like, get the hell out, you know? Mm. So, I mean, that's, but there's going to be, you know, people can be creeping around in costumes. I guarantee it, you know?
Yeah, I bet. I bet. One of the things I really enjoyed in Treme, and you kind of alluded to it a bit here, there, for those who may not have understood the reference, but the Mardi Gras Indians, which is, from what I gather, it's really an African-American tradition that pays homage to the First Nations people of the Americas who, you know, again, in the times of slavery, really took them in. I know there was some you know, cultures such as the Seminole people who, at the time that they were sort of incorporated or incorporated is maybe a polite word for it, but assimilated into American culture, they were really genetically very mixed with the First Nations and with people of African descent. And you get these really extravagant costumes every year. And it seems like there's a call and answer singing form as well that's associated with that.
Oh, yeah. Of, it's a very musical thing. And like, it's, yeah, it's call and response. And, a lot, you know, a group of gentlemen playing tambourines and cowbells and bottles with sticks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one guy, the chief, would sing a line and everybody sings a line. It's just like a sea shanty, except much funkier.
Yeah. Well, it seems that a lot of the origins of the call and answer form of sea shanties does go back to West Africa. So I'm sure there's a link there as well.
I'll bet. Yeah. And like a lot of these shanties are African in origin.
Mm-hmm. And another big day for the Mardi Gras Indians, I think, is St. Joseph's Day, right? March 19th. Mm-hmm. And what's the significance with that, other than it being a Catholic sort of holiday?
I don't know exactly why it is, but it is the day when all the tribes will go out to Bayou St. John area and just kind of congregate, you know, and be pretty and sing and be on display.
And I know that people take a big pride in the costumes and trying to be the prettiest, and the chiefs are all sort of vying with each other. Yes. I never thought of this until now, but is it acceptable to use the same costume you had on Mardi Gras, you know, a month later on St. Joseph's Day? Or, you know, because I know that, like, from what I hear, that the day after Mardi Gras, the preparations already begin for next year.
That's making the costume. That's true. I mean, it takes a year to make a suit. I think that, like, you can bring out an old suit. I don't know. I'm not, you know, this is.
Can you tell that James is planning his post pandemic pilgrimage? He's taking notes. So what outfit do I need?
Oh, I can't wait. I would go back to New Orleans in a heartbeat. I absolutely loved it.
After this chat, I can't wait to go myself.
Well, I don't know specifically what the rules are on that, but I think that probably you wouldn't wear what you had on Mardi Gras at St. Joseph's Day.
Okay.
Or maybe there is, I don't, you know, that's, who would know that? Davis Rogan would know that.
You're going to have to figure that out for James. I think it's important.
So I can put you in touch with people who would know the answer to that question.
Sure. I would love to. That,
you know, if, when you're an Indian chief, you've got a couple suits.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so can, you know, pick out something from your wardrobe.
Alex, in terms of when New Orleans was rebuilding after Katrina, I noticed that in 2006 you began something known as Chaz Fest. Can you tell us a little bit about Chaz Fest?
Yeah, Chaz Fest was, I guess, in reaction to, in 2006, right after the storm, there was some talk about there being no Jazz Fest, which is our big Jazz and Heritage Festival, which happens at the end of April and the beginning of May every year. And I guess it's a long time ago now. What happened is they reduced the number of days of the festival. And so there was less people, you know, local people's bands, or, you know, there were less slots to play. So less, you know, people were not playing at the fairgrounds in greater numbers than usual. And specifically, like, a couple of bands that I'm in and, or I was in at the time, and like friends of mine, I get to know a lot of musicians. And so it was like, hey, wait, my band didn't, oh, you didn't get in. Nobody got in. So we'll, because every year people are like, well, screw it. Let's just go. We'll rent the place across from Jazz Fest and we'll just play outside of there. You know? So we'd always joke about that. And so this year it was like, well, why don't we just do it? We'll just, like, at the time we had this, we lived in this place called the Truck Farm, which was a big property, like a, like almost like a, I don't want to say commune, but it was like, you know, several houses that shared a big green space. And we had a perfect spot to do something, like just have a party. And we knew, you know, we could instantly get 10 bands. And so we found a stage, we put it up, we got a sound system, and we charged $20 at the door, and we had a party, you know. And again, we had no thought of doing it again, but the people had a good time. It's like, oh, and next year it was like, people just started bugging us, will you do Jazz Fest again? And I was like, oh, okay. It was kind of a pain in the ass, but so we just started doing it every year and became kind of an institution. And it was the Wednesday between the Jazz Fest. It was the Thursday between the Jazz Fest weekends. That was originally the, and then we moved it to Wednesday when they put, when Thursday became a day at the actual Jazz Fest again. So it was like, it was on a day that wasn't Jazz Fest. And it was also the bands, we only took bands that were not playing at the Jazz and Heritage Festival. So gotcha. Those are two main criteria. And cool. If you lived at the property, you got, and your band got to play.
Gotcha. So that ran from 2006 to 2017. Is that 2017. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any idea of post-pandemic Jazz Fest ever making an appearance at all?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because the property was sold to these, I don't know, people I don't know. And, you know, the real star of the show was the property. It was a beautiful spot, you know? So I couldn't see doing it somewhere else. It just wouldn't, you know, I like it when things die a natural death, and you could, this is why I sympathize with Bailey from the Saturn Bar.
Mm.
You know, you can't just to keep doing something, just keep doing something. If we still had access to the property and could do it the way we liked to do it, then maybe, I don't know, but, or if we found a place that was similarly as wonderful.
It's funny how we come back to the idea of the music being of the place.
Yeah.
Kind of full circle in the conversation. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's the setting is crucial for a lot of this.
Well, Alex, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thank you very much for making the time.
And before we go, how can people find you, find out more about the Valparaiso Men's Chorus?
Oh God, I think what is the Valparaiso Men's Chorus's website is something I don't know off the top of my head.
People could Google it.
I think it's okay. You can shoot it to us. We'll throw it up in the show notes. We'll get it up there so everyone can find this good stuff.
It might be valparaisomenschorus.com. My website is alexmcmurray.com, and from that website you can find everything that I do, every band, and including Valparaiso. And Valparaiso has its own website, which has, of course, nothing new there. But when we do have a gig, it'll be posted there. And I think we're trying to get started on another record, you know.
Cool. Well, we'd love to hear all about that. And if that footage ever does appear, we'd be very interested in checking
it out. Oh, man. I'll let you know. Yeah.
For sure. Thank you so much. Would you mind leading us out of the show with another shanty?
I would not mind at all. We'll do Holloway Joe, which I guess I found in the Hugo book, but there's also many, many versions. All right. So this one is okay. When I was a little boy, so my mother told me, Timmy,
way haul away, well haul away, Joe.
That if I didn't kiss the girls, my lips would grow all moldy.
Way haul away, well haul away, Joe. Way haul away. Ship now is rolling, tell me, way all the way, we'll all the way, Joe.
Oh, Louis was the king of France before the revolution.
Way all the way, we'll all the way, Joe.
And then he
head cut off, it spoilt his constitution.
Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe. Way Holloway, the good ship now is rolling tight. Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe.
Oh, first I had a Yankee girl, but she was fat and lazy.
Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe.
And then I had an Irish girl, she nearly drove me crazy.
Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe. Way Holloway, the good ship now is rolling to me. Way
from decent people.
Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe.
Built the church in Dublin town, and there he built the steeple.
Way Holloway, Will Holloway Joe. Way Holloway, the good ship now is rolling
to me.
Way
Well, that was amazing.
James, I got the sense you could have talked to him like all day long.
Oh, for sure. For sure. There's so many different things I could have. Yeah.
He was a very generous guest as far as his time and thoughts went. So it was nice to just kind of, shoot the breeze for so long and take whatever we can from that.
Yeah. James, I'm curious because clearly there's something in what Alex and the Valparaiso Men's Chorus are doing that just gets you.
Well, I like anyone that kind of has a different take on music to begin with. And I think all those years I spent playing with the Lemon Bucket Orchestra made me a lot more aware of brass sort of based music and that kind of thing. And then when we got to go down to New Orleans, which is the reason why I went down in the first place to play at the Jazz and Heritage Festival, it was so cool to see the New Orleans brass bands in person on the street corners, you know, with that busking culture that I was referring to. And to just realize that a lot of this, this is where jazz came from. This is where this sort of really recognized and respected tradition comes from. And also to see how it's sort of evolved over the years now with, a lot of the music to me, it's like comes across as really, really funky, you know, it's like, it's a very, updated version of the older brass bands. And there's just so much tradition there and so much, this is a type of music that's over 100 years old now. And so to hear that mixed in with sea shanties is unusual. And at the same time, it works so well.
It was an awesome conversation, and it was awesome how deep you got to go with them. Well, we all did, but I could tell you were right in there.
That was a treat. I was very, very excited. I'm always excited for our guests here. I think we're actually very spoiled for the caliber of people we're getting to chat with. But this was one I was definitely very much looking forward to for a long time. So, I was as happy as a pig in mud.
Okay, well, we got a couple things left to do. First up is let's take a look at today's tall ship. Today's Tallship recommendation comes to us from John in Florida. Take it away, John.
Greetings. I'm John from the Generational Gap podcast, here to talk about my favorite sailing ship, the USS Niagara. Commonly called the U.S. Brig Niagara or the Flagship Niagara, she is a wooden-hulled snow brig that served as the relief flagship for Oliver Hazard Perry in the Battle of Lake Erie during the War of 1812. Niagara is usually docked behind the Erie Maritime Museum in downtown Erie in the state of Pennsylvania. as an outdoor exhibit for the museum. She often travels the Great Lakes during the summer, serving as a training ship for sailing enthusiasts and soon-to-be professional sailors. Niagara was constructed from 1812 to 1813 to protect the vulnerable American coastline on Lake Erie from the British and played a pivotal role in the Battle for the Lake. If you want to find out more about how to become a crew member or simply learn more about the Niagara, visit their website at eriemaritimemuseum.org.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for that. And if you want to find out anything more about today's tall ship, please check out the show notes. We'll put all of the information in there. James, why don't you tell us what we have coming up in the next couple episodes?
All right. Well, coming up, we've got the Johnson Girls, and we're also going to be talking with Dr. Gibb Schreffler, who is one of the preeminent scholarly authorities on shanties nowadays. So stay tuned.
And if you like what we're doing here, please like and subscribe. You know, it's been great to hear all the comments. We're always looking for suggestions on what you'd like to see on the show. And so, yeah, like and subscribe to never miss an episode. Thanks so much for being here. And we will see you next time. Bye, everyone.
Now we are ready to head for the horn.
Way, roll and go.
Our boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the pond.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Hear the Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all stored. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.
Soon we'll be warping a route through the locks.
Way, roll and go.
Where the pretty young girls all come down in their flocks.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Heave a Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all start. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.
Man the stout capstan and heave with a will.
Way, roll and go.
Cause soon we'll be rolling our way down the hill.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Heave a Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all start. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.
Heave away, bullies, ya perish rig bums.
Way, roll and go.
Take your hands from your pockets and don't suck your thumbs.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Heave a Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all start. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.
Sing goodbye to Sally and goodbye to Sue.
Way, roll and go.
Cause we are the boyos that can kick her through.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Heave a Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all start. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.
We're a word bound for Valipo Bay.
Way, roll and go.
Yeah, crackin' my lads, it's a hell of a way.
Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o. Heave a Paula heave away. Way, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables are stored. Tammy rollicking, Randy dandy-o.